Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Good evening and welcome to Ferment About It on heritageradionetwork.org. We are here at the Brooklyn Historical Society with Dr. Pat McGovern, who has recently written his latest book, Ancient Brews. Patrick, welcome to Ferment About It. We're really, really excited to have you here and to talk with you. We are longtime fans, and actually I think it was last year's Homebrew Con, which is happening right now, where Mary got to sit beside you while signing her book, and she was like, "I was just with Pat McGovern."
Oh, really?
She was very tickled to say.
So glad to be here. This is a great chance to talk and find out more about all these extreme beverages.
Extreme beverages. So that is on my list of questions to ask you. When you say extreme beverages, what do you mean?
I mean something that is a whole lot of different ingredients. You know, it could have. You know, depending on what part of the world you're in. So it's like a hybrid beverage of all the natural resources for that region. So if you're in the Middle East, maybe it's barley and wheat and different herbs like coriander, cumin, you know, what's native to that region. If you're over in China, you know, it could be hawthorn fruit, rice, millet. But, you know, you're mixing all these things together because the fermented beverages are really the universal medicine of humankind, you know, probably right from the beginning. So they didn't have synthetic medicines, and if you wanted to live longer than 20 years, you might be out exploring your environment, trying out all different herbs, and figuring out how to ferment all the different natural products in your region. And that would then enable you to get a beverage that had alcohol and some herbal medicines, which would cause you maybe to, you know, not get sick as much and live a little bit longer and reproduce a little bit more. You know, if you just drank regular water, I mean, right. you ran the risk of, you know, imbibing a lot of microorganisms that might not be so good for you.
You go into this in depth in the beginning of your new book. First of all, who are you? Why should we listen to you about that? Why who are you to tell us all this stuff?
Well, I don't know.
Your title is pretty awesome.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Scientific Director of Biomolecular Archaeology.
You know, we work on all the different questions of fermentation, foods, dyes, you know, all the ancient organic materials that might be out there that could have, you know, medicinal effects too, but also have, you know, all kinds of other implications for humans, you know, because most of what we are as humans is our organic creatures. And we surround ourselves with, you know, lots of organic things like clothes and the food and drink that we have and houses and so forth. Of course, we're in a building here that's all brick and concrete and cast iron from the 1800s. So that part of it, is the inorganic side of things as well. But the organic side, we don't really get as good preservation in antiquity as we'd like. So especially for like the Paleolithic period, we, you know, we have like 99% of humans' time on Earth, and yet, you know, we have very, very, small percentage of the available evidence. But why should you listen to me? Well, I've been, working at this for a while. Mm-hmm. I don't have all the answers, but I've been a sort of a combination archaeologist, chemist, going on, I guess, 40 years.
40 years. And some of the beers that have been made commercially for people to experience through your partnership with Dogfish Head, it's our people's first time, kind of our closest kind of glimpse into these recreations of the past. And one of the things you say is that the answers to recreating these beverages is not always easy. What are the best guesses, or what are the approaches to the best guesses of recreation?
So that's what the book is really trying to approach, is, what are all the issues involved, and, how do we establish, first of all, what the main ingredients might have been in a certain area and to go into a certain beverage. And so we have all the chemical techniques that we use, the botanical findings that we refer to. And then we have to try to figure out, what the processes would have been in antiquity. And so, we have certain clues about that, but not always a lot. We can, sometimes say maybe there was likely cold mashing, let's say, for a beer because they wanted to preserve their fuel. And, we may not have, stoves or fireplaces, that are clearly used, for heating up the beverage. But then you might go and look at artistic depictions in Egyptian tombs. So we have some of the earliest, very detailed frescoes inside of tombs in Egypt going back to about 3000 BC of the earliest beer making and wine making. So we can see, they're going through a whole series of steps. It involves usually baking bread in Egypt and Mesopotamia as well, because you put the bakery and the brewery very close together. And because they're using the same raw materials, yeah. And you can see them measuring out the grains, probably barley or wheat in this case, and have a scribe nearby recording it. I mean, this is at 3000 BC, so this is at the beginning of writing. and then they go on and they show different sort of operations that we can think of as malting or mashing. But there's always going to be controversy about what is really being depicted. And you have to then try to get archaeological evidence that would substantiate what's in the pictures. Mm-hmm. And the pictures go on for thousands of years, the same pictures. Mm-hmm. Because once they have the sort of canonical representation of how you make beer for the afterlife or wine for the afterlife, I guess you don't want to deviate from that, because maybe that's going to ruin the beer or wine and you're not going to produce it. I mean, we don't know, but they got a formula, they follow it, and we'd like to figure out more about that. So that's like a really complicated process of archaeology and artistic analysis and textual, because there are little hieroglyphics, usually describing the scene near it, like sort of comic strip type descriptions, very short, mm-hmm. and so on. That may say,
but you also have some comics in your book, you and
Sam. Yeah, right. And so then once you get, to some sort of idea what the process is, what yeast was used, what microorganisms went into it. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, another mystery that you have to try to solve. You can do some DNA research on ancient yeast. We've done that for Egypt and, figured out we have an early Saccharomyces cerevisiae, whatever. But we don't necessarily have access to that to today. So then we might want to go ahead and try to reconstruct what the original yeast was. And we've tried that for the Italian Etrusca recreation. We might try to get some wild yeast like we did in Egypt, going out into a date palm grove. But we don't know if it's really wild, because it's recent. And it may have, crossed with all sorts of other things, since, for the last 5,000 years. So it's just taking all the different clues we have and then trying to work up what would be a suitable interpretation for that time and place. And then since we assume, too, that humans have had basically the same physiological receptors, sensory receptors and enzyme systems and so forth, and mind-altering you know, neurotransmitters and so on, that they would have known what they liked.
Right.
And, of course, taste can vary from culture to culture, but, you know, humans still have basically the same operating system.
So we
want to make something
that euphoria.
You know, if it's made for a king, we want to, you know, try to make it as tasty as we possibly can and so forth.
Yeah, you do address, you know, the issues of why do we drink, and include, you know, as it is a social lubricant also sitting around.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's been right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, it breaks down the boundaries between people and opens them up to each other in different ways, you know.
You also
socially, reproductively, etc.
As a brewer or a barkeep or like working in a, you know, behind the bar a lot, you know, we have these fruit flies all the time.
You
touched on the what was the study they did with fruit flies?
Studies, you know, showing like the genetic composition they have for inebriation, which includes a lot of the same genes that we have for drunkenness, which go by names like barfly, amnesiac, happy hour.
Yeah. You're so attracted to wine.
Yeah, they're very interested in, you know, the sugar and the alcohol.
Yeah.
And they even feed their young alcohol.
So they feed their young, like birds, the way birds do? Like they suck it in and then feed it?
I think the way they do it, let's see. I think that, yeah, they may do it that way. I got to recheck that.
But you worked with Sam also when he harvested the yeast from the wasp. Is that you worked with you on that?
On which?
From the belly of the bee or the wasp?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was from the fruit fly. The Egyptian yeast.
Okay, gotcha, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I didn't really bring that out in the book, and I should have. That was a story that he came up with later after I'd written it, pretty much, which I guess is true. That's what they had, the fruit flies, and they had their stomach contents, and they were able to extract the yeast from that. Yeah, because they got stuck, I guess, in the agar dishes that they put out overnight in the date palm grove. So that's pretty interesting, I think. And you know, microorganisms in general, you know, our whole gastrointestinal system, you know, has all these microorganisms doing a lot of the fermentation and pre-fermentation, you know, preparing the food to be really totally, you know, extracted. And I think there's a study now for roundworms in which they don't actually necessarily consume a fermented fruit or honey or whatever, but they have microorganisms producing alcohol in their GI tract, which gets them drunk. A roundworm.
So like the ones that we use for like horticulture.
Yeah, it's like a really standard organism that's, you know, been studied.
There's a story a year back about a human having that condition. I don't know if it was lore about auto fermentation system.
Oh, yeah?
That's right. That wheat would ferment in his stomach.
Yeah.
And he would be perpetually drunk.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So that's the same idea. Right.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
I love in this book that at the end of each chapter you give homebrew recipes, but in addition to that you give cooking recipes about old school things that might be great and delicious with these, like the goose.
Whole
the whole
roasted goose.
So which one was that one with that?
That's with Tahanka, the Egyptian one we did, you know, for the Discovery Channel Master Brewers. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that was from a chef over in Norway who did a bunch of those. And he was out on his ship in the North Sea dreaming up these recipes, too. And, you know, I would give him all the sort of background information on what was possible for Egypt. Now, when you go into the tomb, the earliest tomb that has the depiction of beer making, the one of the scenes, they have a lot of other agricultural scenes, you know, of tilling the fields and so forth. But one is force feeding geese to make foie gras. Mm. So this is like 2450 BC. And they're already having foie gras. So we didn't put that in the book, but I always said we should really put in a foie gras recipe, too, because that would be very appropriate.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That it goes back that far.
Yeah, because we were trying to, you know, that Tahankit, which was not very popular because it had very strong spices, many spices, the one called za'atar.
Oh, I love za'atar.
Yeah, I do, too.
But I don't know if I would want it in a drink.
Yeah, well, that was the issue. You know, some people, you know, they didn't really like it. They'd never experienced it before, so they had problems with it.
Oh,
the other thing I was going to say about Tahankit is, you know, it draws upon evidence not just of that tomb that's very early for the beer depiction, but also it goes back to 18,000 years where we had botanical information, archaeobotanical information, like of chamomile, dom, palm fruit, different types of roots, like bulrush and millet and so forth. So, you know, we tried to, you know, when we did that program for the brewmasters, we went through the Cairo Bazaar, sort of picking out all these ingredients, which then included, you know, some of these really strong spices that people didn't care for. But if you let it age, now I bought up all, and when they took it off the market, and I went out and bought as much as I could. And so I've been letting it age, and it's really starting to mellow out. You know,
why did they take it off the market?
Because of those strong spices. They got too many negatives.
Oh, sorry. Not the spice. They didn't take the spice off the market.
No.
You're talking about the beer itself.
The beer itself.
That's like half the spices. Yeah. Really doesn't do the other thing.
No, that would be unfair probably. But you can always tame it down. And, you know, we did that with the chocolate beverage. I mean, I always said it should have more chocolate in it. But
the Theo Brahma?
The Theo Brahma. We're going to try it tonight. Yeah. But it's a very subtle hint of dark chocolate that comes through on the aroma and the taste. But it's... And I always told Sam, I said, well, you know, why don't you up the chocolate? If we're going to have a chocolate beverage, we really should, you know, maybe taste more of the chocolate. So then he threw in so much chocolate that I, you know, I recoiled, you know, said, no, that's way too much. But
yeah. He's nothing if not audacious. So.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But the first beer that you guys did together was the Midas Touch. And where did that stem from? And tell us about that.
Right, that's the
not to make you tell that story one more
time. No, I know. So tell the story a lot, but it's a great, it's a good story because it's, you know, we came together very fortuitously there in Philadelphia, and you know, he was doing his sort of wild, crazy thing, and we were working on, you know, these ancient beverages and finding out that, in fact, they were pretty wild and crazy back then, and so we weren't that far apart, both intellectually. Beer drinking wise and so forth. Like and I was already, you know, pretty much predisposed to them. Now, as far as the actual residues that we worked on, you know, inside this tomb, the Penn Museum had excavated those back in 1957, and they had the foresight to bring the residues back to Philadelphia. So they were sitting in a storeroom for, you know, maybe 30, 40 years until I came along, and in a room just two flights of stairs up from my laboratory. So it was, I say it's the easiest excavation I was ever on. I just
it's
went
above you.
Yeah, they're still in their original paper bags.
Wow.
It should have been climate controlled better, but that's another story.
Sure.
Anyway, we got going on the analysis, and we had this very strange beverage, you know, combined grape wine, barley, beer, and honey mead. Every year we used to have Michael Jackson, not the entertainer.
Yes.
We know who we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
He'd come to Penn Museum and do a tasting, and we'd have a dinner the night before. And on that particular night, this was like in 2000, as a roasting and toasting event. So I, everybody, was saying what they thought about Michael Jackson, and I finally thought, well, maybe I'll just, present the new information that we have on the Midas beverage, which is really an extreme beverage, especially at that time. And there was a lot of microbrewers in the audience because they're coming for the grand tasting the next day, in which they're going to present their brews. And I said, well, I explained, I just went through as far as how this is such an unusual beverage. I never imagined, mixing wine and beer together. Mm-hmm. It just sounded, awful.
When did they start doing braggots, or how old is that?
Well, braggots go back into the Middle Ages, yeah. But, we've sort of lost track of it. Once Piss Light took over, there wasn't much braggot being produced. Now, at that particular dinner, what was interesting...
And this is 2000?
2000.
Yeah.
Sam had prepared a braggot for the dessert beer.
Yeah.
And, of course, that, had all the same sort of combination of ingredients that the Midas drink had, except it had plums instead of grapes, but it had the barley and it had the honey. And so it really was, very close, in a way, to what the Midas recreation could be.
Yeah.
And like I said, I was already predisposed to him because I'd had his... Shelter Pale Ale just by accident, and when I stopped off at Buckley's Tavern, I don't know if I talked about that in the book, I probably did, and we went back to Buckley's Tavern before I wrote the book to talk about doing it.
Yeah.
And so we had our reunion. It's the only time we've really been back to Buckley's Tavern, but I really thought that was such a great beer, and it gave me the idea that it wasn't just wine that could be aromatic, but also beers. And so I was really sort of predisposed to him, and also then the plum braggot at the dinner. And what I suggested was we have a competition among all the microbrewers there, and they could come to my laboratory the next day at 9 a.m., which would be a Saturday, mm-hmm. After they've been drinking all night. Yeah. And if they were really interested, and I'd give them more details so they could go back, try their experiments. Because we were going to do like a recreation of the whole funerary feast.
Right.
And so the idea was to get the best Midas brew we could to go with the barbecued lamb and lentil stew that we had chemical evidence for, too.
And they did, yeah.
Yeah, so they then started playing around with all the different spices, and there was about 20 or 30 of them that showed up, I guess 20. I sometimes exaggerate, the next
never
morning.
Never the truth yet, with a good story. Never
yeah, that's why it's about stories.
That's right.
Yeah, and Sam has lots of those too, of course.
Yeah,
and so they.
He's a writer.
Yeah, right. So that was kind of surprising. There were so many that were interested, and they started sending me, their experiments, because my job, which is a very tough one, was to taste them and decide, mm-hmm. What might fit the bill the best. And so, even though I'm in Pennsylvania, where it's technically illegal to receive such beverages at my home, mm-hmm. They started arriving on my doorstep and.
Yeast samples, right?
That's
how you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeast samples.
Yeah.
And then, eventually, of course, Dogfish. I suggested to Sam that maybe saffron would be the bittering agent that would work best. And mm-hmm. He tried that. He said it was the most expensive beer ever made. But he did a really great interpretation.
It's a beautiful beer. And since then, you've done how many collaborations together?
We have nine total of recreated beverages, not all of which are easy to get. Midas Touch is made every month,
right?
So that's good.
I'm sure we'll talk about this in the panel a little bit about kind of like recreating beers and this the want for sustainability and attractiveness to the consumer. Like, it's very fun to recreate these things, but how patterns of taste are changing and diversity of experience and what you get here are able to have access to is a pretty big. What do you think the value is in recreation versus
experimenting with the variables, seeing what you know what's possible, and trying to take some of the ancient techniques, applying them to the modern situation in all different ways. I mean, you can do different kinds of materials, like pottery versus, like we did with Etrusca. You have a version that's made in pottery, like Etruscan pottery, ancient.
Right. Right.
And you have another version made in oak barrels, and another version made with bronze, imitating a bronze vessel. So those are the two, pottery and bronze were you know, well attested in that early Etruscan period, 800, 700 BC. Oak barrels, we don't really have the evidence for that yet, but it's likely they were able to make ships and bend wood, and it could just be a selective decomposition. You know, we haven't found the evidence yet for the oak barrels. I mean, that comes later with the Celts and Romans.
Oh, yeah.
But it could be earlier. So that's another thing we is a possibility. But then just, you know, playing with all these variables, I think, is really the exciting part of it. Mm-hmm. And seeing eventually, I mean, you should really do scientific studies where you see, you know, what contribution or what chemical reactions are occurring and that kind of thing.
It's interesting, we've gone kind of a little bit backwards by way of flavor trends and how sour beers are and just wild beers are, that we've embraced that once more again, where that used to be regular and all that there was to deal with. I'm curious to see how the blending of science and this interaction creates more controlled sour.
Oh, yeah. Well, there have been articles now that show that, for lambics, there's 2,000 microorganisms at work over a three-year period, and they go up and down, you know, in frequency. Fortunately, the good guys went out at the end.
But that battle, yeah, I've seen those graphs with the different ones. This is how healthy they were at any time, and they're, reproducing.
So it's a battle. But then, you know, life is a battle. So it's, you know, we don't like to think of it that way, but it really is.
In this book, you share anecdotes about your travels and thoughts about the history in each region and how these beverages came to be. And I just want to thank you for sharing that, because a lot of us can't go and have these experiences to that place. And I recommend this book to anybody able to get it. Where can you get it?
Oh, yeah, I think you can get it in bookstores and online and...
Ancient brews rediscovered and recreated, including homebrew interpretations and meal pairings. And Pat, what's next? The book tour?
Yeah, we're doing the book tour right now. And, you know, going out to the homebrewers conference in Minneapolis in a couple of days, or tomorrow, in fact. And, you know, I just think it's a growing phenomenon. It's, I mean, we've just, you know, sort of touched the tip of the fermented beverage pyramid here, and there's a lot more to really rediscover and to recreate.
You mentioned that you're, you know, one of your ideal recreations are basically the stuff that you, there's not enough information for yet. We're still talking about Paleolithic and maybe dino brew.
I think you call it dino brew. Well, I'm sure the dinosaurs were attracted to it, just like it's a fermented fruits and honey and so forth, just like birds are.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people have had the experience of seeing birds, you know, get drunk and crash into windows, which they do.
Sadly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder what a drunk dinosaur is.
Yeah, I would be afraid. Sure. It's sort of like a drunk elephant. You know, like in India, the elephants will break into breweries and get drunk and start stomping around, killing people, and buildings crushed.
Yeah. Yeah, flying with their ears also.
Yeah, but
those crazy pink elements flying.
So you guys are doing a panel tonight in about like 20 minutes, like
is it
10
that
minutes.
Soon?
Okay, is that soon?
It's at 6:30.
No, 7.
Door is 6:30. Oh, 7. Right, okay, 7. Yeah. So you guys are doing it in like half an hour. So all of the listeners who might be hearing this have already missed it. So you guys want to give us a primer about what you guys are going to be talking about? What's going to happen at this panel?
I think we just covered it in Ferment About It. No, we'll talk. I think we'll talk about the entire book mission, wherever the conversation
will go, wherever the conversation takes us.
But from what I understand, some of the questions kind of encompass kind of me as a new brewer. How am I going to take this information from past and incorporate it into, or why would I want to incorporate it into beers of the future? I think some of the things that we talked about are beer trends, both, you know. What people like processes to use and incorporate that you've shared in this book. That I'm not through with the book, but it's awesome. I mean, you really shared a lot of really, really fascinating stuff. And I respect the history of this art and art form, and for people like you to share it in this manner.
Well, the other thing we do in the book, and it's online on my website, is we go beyond just the food and the drink. And we do, you know, what would be the appropriate music to play, what would be the right clothes maybe to have on, you know, the physical setting and so forth. And so this sort of fits in with the idea that fermented beverages contributed probably in a very direct way to the arts, because, you know, people who are poetically inclined, musically inclined, so forth, you know, are sometimes helped along by a little mind altering.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Speaking for sure. That's
absolutely true. Yeah.
And plus, the people who don't come tonight are missing out on Midas Touch, which you can get, but they're missing out on Chateau Jiahu, which is the oldest alcoholic beverage we've identified from China.
That's like 9,000?
Yeah, 9,000 years ago.
Yeah, what's that fermented from?
It's similar, you know, in a way it's not that different from Midas Touch, but it has rice instead of barley, and it has hawthorn fruit in addition to grapes, and it has honey. But, you know, honey is the highest source concentration of sugar in nature, so, you know, all these cultures, you know, are very attracted to that as a resource for doing a fermented beverage. And where we started out in Africa, of course, they had honey, they had dates and figs and so forth that they would have been able to use. And then the other one is theobroma they're going to miss out on, which is the chocolate beverage, which is very exciting.
This one with more chocolate.
Yeah, well, no, this one has
been dialed back.
I've been brought into the fold that likes this more subtle approach. But it has chilies in the aftertaste, and it has a spice, achiote or natto seeds, which gives a reddish color to it, because ancient Mayan and Aztec people, when you were going to sacrifice a beautiful male, you gave them a final, give them some courage. You would give them the honey beverage or the chocolate beverage with blood from a previous sacrifice mixed in. Well, we decided we didn't want to go with the blood interpretation, so we used the spice. It's also mentioned in the text as giving a reddish color, achiote or annatto.
Didn't speak to the flavor of the blood, just the color of it.
Yeah, more of the color.
Yeah. Cool.
I imagine it tastes like iron.
Iron. Oh, yeah, you could add some iron. Right. Well, Dr. Pat McGovern, thank you so much.
Okay, well, thank you.
Ferment About It.
Yes.
Thank you.
Ferment About It.
Ferment About It.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Fresh Pickings is a podcast by Heritage Radio Network presented by Bob's Red Mill. Love learning about food? Get more superfood for your brain with the featured podcast miniseries, Fresh Pickings. Go to bobsredmill.com/freshpickings.
Today on Fresh Pickings, we're talking about vehicles. No, not the kind with four-wheel drive. We're talking about the edible vehicles that transport your carne asada, beans, and rice from the taco truck to your hungry mouth. Ever wonder how your 2-pound burrito could possibly fit all of those ingredients without totally exploding? Well, that's all thanks to masa, the corn flour used to make tortillas, sopas, and pupusas. While solid masa dough is traditionally sold in Mexican grocery stores in the refrigerator aisle, Bob's Red Mill makes things easier by offering a non-perishable powdered version of the same stuff. In Spanish, masa harina or masa harina literally translates to dough flour, and when mixed with water, transforms to a malleable dough that can be used in a variety of dishes. How is masa harina made, and what is it used for? To tell us more about the magic of masa harina, I've got Dave Arnold, co-host of Cooking Issues, and I'll pay a visit to Fanny Gerson at her handmade donut shop, Dough, in Manhattan. I'm your host, Kat Johnson. Stay tuned. I'm here with Katie Mosman-Wadler, the Executive Director of Heritage Radio Network. Katie, how do you like to eat your tacos? In a hard shell or soft shell?
Definitely soft shell all the way.
Why do you like soft shell more than hard shell?
Well, soft shell tacos, first of all, if the tortilla is fresh, it's a really delicious part of the whole experience. They stay intact better, and you can put more stuff in them. Hard shell tacos, I see their merits, but they're really crumbly. They can make a big mess, and I just love the taste of a fresh tortilla.
And then what do you like to put in the taco?
Well, it is a super hot day in New York City today, so I am thinking about fish tacos, which is one of my favorite kind of summer easy dinner foods. I like to grill some fish, and then I make a really delicious mango salsa with some red pepper and mint and lime, and throw that together. I make really good guacamole. So fish tacos with lots of cilantro and probably a Modelo Especial to go with that.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to have to invite myself over for a taco party soon. I'll bring mezcal.
Okay, you're on. Sounds great.
These days, Mexican food seems to be more and more common in the average American's diet. Tortillas are replacing white bread, and spicy pork is replacing your deli meat. We've come a long way since Jack in the Box seemed to be the only place to buy tacos. Now you can pick up a breakfast burrito from your local bodega and tamales from stands on the side of the road. But everyone knows the difference between a good and a great quesadilla starts with a tortilla. To achieve optimum deliciousness, tortillas must be made fresh using pure corn flour like that of Bob's Red Mill's Masa Harina. Everyone asks people about favorite pizza toppings, but to keep up with the times, let's talk about favorite taco toppings. My favorite is cilantro. What's yours?
So if it's carne asada and it's like, then I like it very simple. I like some pickled onion and lime, and maybe, a little bit of a hot sauce, but I like it pretty spare. But, I'm also a sucker for American, like lots of chopped lettuce and cheese. I mean, I can go many different ways, but I always go soft.
This is Dave Arnold, co-host of Cooking Issues here on Heritage Radio Network. He is a culinary daredevil and expert on Masa Harina. So how is Masa Harina made?
So typically, what you would do with corn, the difference between cornmeal and Masa Harina is that the corn in Masa Harina has gone through a process called nixtamalization. And when you nixtamalize something, you par cook it, then soak it in an alkaline solution. And the classic one that you use in Mexico, Central America, would be calcium hydroxide or lime. They call it slaked lime. And that makes the real kind of typical aroma. So think tortilla chip versus cornbread as an aroma difference. It also changes the nutritional balance of the corn and allows you to use the whole corn and basically nothing but the corn to make tortillas. So they nixtamalize the corn, then they dry it, grind it to a flour, and then it's basically add water and instant tortilla fun.
So explain to me why I can't just use cornmeal to make tortillas.
Well, you'd be the worst person in the world if you did that. If you use straight cornmeal to make tortillas, like you would instantly be consigned to the dustbin of terrible enemy of quality bad cooks. It just doesn't work. I mean, first of all, like the texture won't be right because nixtamalization adds from the outside skin portion of the corn and the germ adds a certain amount of fat and a certain amount of hydrocolloids that are necessary for the actual structure of a tortilla. Which is why it's interesting. It doesn't require like added structural components like wheat flour. It's just corn. And additionally, it won't have that aroma and taste of nixtamalized corn. Like I say, think like opening up a bag of tortilla chips versus opening a bag of cornmeal. It's not the same product.
Are there health benefits to using Masa Harina as opposed to white flour?
I would never substitute flour for masa or vice versa, ever. I mean, there's like different. I mean, that's not true. So, we have on the show actually today Richard Blaze, and he uses masa as a fry coating. And I know some other people that make very crunchy fry coatings with Masa Harina, so it's a good application. Everyone likes the taste of it, but it's not a one-to-one swap, I don't think. But from a nutritional standpoint, I mean, they're just different. Masa is, well, I guess more than technically a whole grain. You're dealing with a whole grain product.
Fanny Gerson is one of the country's most authoritative voices on Mexican cuisine, and in particular, Mexican confections. She's written 3 books, and her first, My Sweet Mexico, was nominated for a James Beard Award for Best Baking and Pastry Cookbook. Today, Fanny is sitting down with me at the Flatiron location of Dough, her handmade donut shop, and we're going to talk about masa harina. So thanks for having me, Fanny.
Thanks for having me.
So when we think about masa harina, a lot of us think about tortillas. But since you are known for sweets, I wanted to ask you, how do you typically use masa harina?
So when it comes to sweet, I think of 2 things mainly. So I think of tamales, but sweet tamales, which aren't as known as the savory ones, but they're so good. And I also think of atoles, which are sort of these thick porridge-like beverages, and they're made with different kinds of grains like amaranth and rice, but my favorite is the ones that are made with corn.
So do you think that masa harina is an easy ingredient for people to use at home?
I think masa harina is very easy for people to use at home, but I think it's like one of those things that if you haven't used or didn't grow up with it, it can be intimidating because you don't really know what to do with it. But it's actually a very good thing to have around because it can sit in the shelf for a long time and you can really use it to whip up something very delicious very fast.
Do you have any particular tips for people at home who are trying to use masa harina for the first time?
So I think that, you know, when you see a recipe for, you know, anything that you do with masa harina, use the ratios that they give you as just a general guideline, but use your instinct. Because if you use the same recipe in a place that's humid versus a place that's dry, it's definitely going to affect the texture. So, you know, when you mix it with the liquid or the water, you know, for most cases, you want to make sure it's not very dry. And then just as you add the liquid, just go slowly when you use it for those preparations. Or if you use it, let's say, even to make tortillas or to make something like that. Like, really, you want to make sure that as you handle it, it doesn't crack.
Great. So tell me about the recipe that you're sharing with us for this episode.
So this recipe is one of the recipes that's in my my Sweet Mexico, and it's one of my favorite in the book. It's a lime tamal, and you get the flavor of the lime from lime zest. And you can actually use the base recipe to use it. You know, you can use orange zest or you can use grapefruit zest, and you can add some fruit inside, and I really love it. It tastes kind of like a very light pound cake, but it's made with corn.
That sounds delicious. Well, thanks, Fanny. You can hear more from Fanny Gerson on episode 240 of A Taste of the Past and episode 2 of Food Without Borders on heritageradionetwork.org. Well, that's just about everything you could want to know about masa harina. If you liked what you heard, be sure to check out our other episodes of Fresh Pickings and learn more about Bob's Red Mill's favorite ingredients, including some delicious recipes and great coupon offers, by going to bobsredmill.com/freshpickings. Bob's Red Mill believes in good food for all. For Heritage Radio Network, I'm your host, Kat Johnson. Thanks for joining us.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.